Would you turn in Luke's Gospel to chapter 2, and continuing our studies in this Gospel very appropriately and not without some degree of design, we are in the Christmas story at the Christmas season. And so I just want to read this passage that we're going to be looking at briefly this morning in chapter 2 and verses 1 through 7. We're told, "In those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling cloths, and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn." Well, the Christmas story is familiar to us, isn't it? We're on familiar territory when we come to this passage and its surrounding passages. Even the youngest ones here this morning know about the shepherds on the hillside and the angels coming and announcing the birth of Jesus. They know about the wise men coming from the east following the star and finding Jesus there in Bethlehem. They know the story of the hatred of Herod and his desire to kill every child who would have been about the age of Jesus at that time, so that he could protect his throne from this new king who had been born. We're familiar with these aspects of the Christmas story, and even though we may forget the name of Quirinius, governor in Syria, we nevertheless know that the reason why Mary and Joseph happened to be in Bethlehem and not in Nazareth was because of this decree of Caesar Augustus. And so the story is familiar, and we can have, I guess, a temptation to turn off, to switch off and say, well, we know this, we've covered this, we know what this is all about. And I'm sure that you do. So there's nothing new this morning in what I have to say, just to remind you about old truths that are worth repeating, and well worth repeating. We want to observe the place of the birth of Jesus Christ as it's presented to us here. We know that he was born in Bethlehem, but we also know, as we have seen, that his mother Mary lived in Nazareth. And how was it that Mary and Joseph were in Bethlehem at the time of the birth? Well, it is this decree that went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world, that is all the Roman Empire, should be registered. There's some dispute and debate about the accuracy of Luke's account here, because there is no evidence outside of the Bible that a registration, a census was taken at the particular time that we think that Jesus would have been born, somewhere between 6 and 4 BC. There was a registration, a census taken in about 6 AD, which would have been when Jesus was 10 or 12 years old. But there's no external evidence that one was taken at this time, though both Caesar Augustus and Quirinius were in these particular roles at the appropriate time. And so we shouldn't jump to the conclusion that because there's no extra biblical evidence that Luke got it wrong and his dates are wrong and he's inserted a later event into these events to explain how Jesus could have been born in Bethlehem. Now, we can take the accuracy of the biblical account and recognize that not everything that happened is recorded in the history books, and that this decree also went out from Caesar and this registration did take place, and Mary and Joseph did have to travel from Nazareth to Bethlehem for this purpose. And we see in all of this that God is working. that God is working. He had prophesied, as we read earlier, in Micah chapter 5 and verse 2, and as is quoted by the elders and the priests in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 2, the prophecy was that the Messiah, the promised one, would be born in Bethlehem. And God is working. He's working sovereignly. He is the one who turns the hearts of kings and emperors to make their decrees at the appropriate time and to call for the appropriate circumstances. And God then is sovereignly working, overruling in this story to bring about his purposes. These aren't accidents of history. God has been working all the way through history. He was working all the way through the Old Testament when he put in place the laws at Mount Sinai that would govern the children of Israel. And he put in place all the ceremonies that were to be followed and pursued day after day after day. He put those in place. And he ensured that they remained in place so that at the appropriate time, a man called Zechariah would enter into the temple to burn incense, because this is what had been done day after day, year after year, century after century, since the time of the Exodus. And there he encountered the angel who told him that now the time had come. Now the forerunner of the Lord would be born, and would be born to Zechariah's wife. Now was the time for the Lord's Messiah to enter into the world, and he was preparing the way for him. All of these things, you see, are God sovereignly at work. And we can trace through the Old Testament, and we can see time after time after time that God is putting in place various things to ensure that this single event in history would come to pass. And it came to pass exactly as God decreed it would. And so in this account, when we read of the decree of Caesar Augustus, what we are doing is we're reading of the sovereign purposes of God being fulfilled. God is bringing about his purposes to bring a saviour into the world as he had promised, in the place that he has promised, and in the way that he had promised. The very place of the birth of Jesus indicates to us the sovereignty of God. A God who is still sovereign. He's sovereign today. He's in control today. He is working out his purposes in our lives today. Why are you here this morning? Well, because God wants you to be here this morning. That's the only reason that you're in this room this morning, is because God has determined that this is where you will be. That God has determined that you will hear this message this morning, and that perhaps this message will have such a huge impact upon your life. It will completely transform you, not just for today, not just for this Christmas, but forever. God is in control. He is working out his purposes. So we see the place of his birth speaks to us of the sovereignty of God. Nothing in the Christmas story that we have in the accounts of the Gospels is happening by accident. It is happening under God's decree. The second thing that we should observe here is the circumstances of the birth of Jesus. Most of these seven verses are taken up with the fact that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and the way in which this came about. But then the last couple of verses speak about the fact that while they were in Bethlehem, Mary and Joseph, that is, it came time for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloths, and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn. The circumstances of Jesus' birth are both very ordinary and also fairly unusual. At least they're unusual to our way of thinking. to think of a baby being born in a stable and being laid to rest in a feeding trough for the animals in that stable, that seems pretty strange to us. And yet Luke declares it fairly matter-of-factly, doesn't he? And he doesn't really dwell upon it, he just mentions these things, and as we'll see next time, the angels use the unusual circumstances of the birth of Jesus as a way in which the shepherds will know when they found the promised one, that he will be lying in a manger. Well, not too many babies in Bethlehem would be lying in a manger that night. And so there were some unusual aspects to it. But Jesus really was born in a very ordinary way to an ordinary person. They were in what may have been the lower level of an inn. It says that there was no place for them in the inn. And there was two common ways that these inns were constructed. One was that there was a ground floor in which the animals of the travellers would be kept. And then there was an upper floor where the people would stay. And so when it tells us that there was no room for them in the inn, it could simply be telling us that there was no room for them in the place where the people were staying. And so they were limited to this lower area. And that was all the space that there was for them. Another way that these travelling places were constructed was that there would be on the ground floor a room where people would stay, or rooms, and then next to it there would be a stable. And I guess that's what we think of when we think of the birth of Jesus, in a stable, a separate building where the horses and donkeys of the travellers were being kept. Or we might even think that this was some local farmer's stable, and there are the sheep, and there are the oxen, and all these animals with smiling faces, if the Christmas cards are to be believed, are arrayed around this feeding trough, and there's the baby Jesus with a halo around his head. Well, no, these were very humble people in humble circumstances. Jesus was born into a degree of poverty, certainly, but he wasn't the poorest of the poor. His legal father, Joseph, was a carpenter. He had gainful employment, and there's no indication that they were, in such dire straits that they were begging. But the circumstances of there being a census at this time, a registration, and everyone having to go back to their hometown would have brought many of the descendants of David back to Bethlehem. And so the place is full of travellers who have come there in order to register under Caesar Augustus. The thing that I want us to focus on here, more than the human circumstances of the birth of Jesus and the explanations we might give for them, is the contrasting circumstances. We need to remember that this is the Lord of glory who was born here in this stable, or this lower floor of the inn, and placed in a manger. This is the one who spoke the world into existence. There's a song that you will have heard a number of times this Christmas already, I suppose. Mary, did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water? And so it goes on about the things that her baby boy would do. And it's a wonderful song, talking about the life that Jesus would live and the death that Jesus would die. Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters? Well, she didn't know. She couldn't know all that her son would do as he lay there in the manger. But one of the lines in that song is, when you kiss your little baby, you kiss the face of God. Those are incredible words, because they're true. their true words. There, in that manger, in that stable, or in that inn, is the God of creation. Our God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man, as the hymn writer puts it. Or as I've entitled this message, this is undercover majesty. That's a line from another song that is not very familiar, has a very small circulation. But a wonderful image is generated by those words, undercover majesty. God has come into this world and he's there in that stable. He's there in the form of that little baby that Mary is nursing and laying in that manger to sleep. This child that is born in such humble circumstances is the one who has reigned from eternity, who has created the heavens and the earth and all that is in them. This child that is there in this manger is the one whom Isaiah saw and that he speaks of in Isaiah chapter 6, where we read in the first verses of that chapter that in the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew, and one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And John tells us in his gospel that what Isaiah saw was the Son of God. What Isaiah saw was Jesus before he had come into this world as a man. And Isaiah bowed down before this vision of Jesus and said, "Woe is me, I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the midst of the people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." And he is this King. He is the Lord of hosts. He's lying in a manger, in a stable, in such humble circumstances. Isn't that an amazing thing? That our God should stoop so low. This is what Paul talks about in Philippians chapter 2, verse 6, where he talks about Jesus being equal with God, but not counting equality with God a thing to be clung to, but he emptied himself and he became nothing, became a servant. These are the circumstances of the birth of the Son of God as the Son of Man in these humble circumstances. What a contrast to what he had been. And hardly anyone notices, hardly anyone recognizes it. Yes, the shepherds will come a little later on and they'll come and they'll worship before him, having had the announcement from the angels. And yes, some time later, weeks later, months later, we don't know exactly how much time later, the wise men from the east arrive. They have seen a star that has spoken to them of the birth of someone special, someone important, and they followed that star and it's led them to Judea, and they naturally go to Jerusalem, to the palace, to where Herod lives, and they ask about the baby, the new king that's been born, because obviously a king is going to be born in a palace, isn't he? But not this king. This king's born in a stable. I wonder what the wise men thought. We're not told, are we? But what did they think in terms of Herod's strange reaction? King? Here? No, I'm the only king here. No one else. And then obviously in private, he calls for the teachers, the elders, and he asks them, well, who is this king? Where's he going to be born? And immediately they quote from the Old Testament scriptures and say, well, in Bethlehem. And then Herod summons the wise men and he tells them, you go and search for him in Bethlehem. Why doesn't Herod go? Why is he sending them? Why doesn't he send his servants? This is a strange thing. I wonder what the wise men must have thought at the response, the reaction of Herod at that time. And then when they follow the star that little bit further and it comes to rest above the place where Jesus is, and he's moved now, he's no longer in the inn, he's in a house now. Some weeks have passed, some months perhaps have passed, and they've found a place as the people who came to register have gone back to their homes and they've remained there. And so the wise men come maybe to a little house there in Bethlehem and they find this very ordinary little family. But they believe that the star has spoken truth to them and they worship this little child. And they bring their gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh and place them before him. And then they depart. They're wise men. They bring rich gifts. They expect to come to a king. And they do come to a king, but he doesn't look like a king. Just an ordinary little baby with an ordinary family living in an ordinary house in an ordinary little village in Judea. This is our God who has come to us. This is the humility of our Saviour who identifies himself with ordinary people. And isn't it interesting when you work through the Bible, when you read the Old Testament, for example, over and over and over again, God displays a concern for the ordinary people. He displays a connection with those who are just ordinary, of no consequence. He doesn't identify so much with the leaders, with the rulers, with the kings. He's always concerned about how are the ordinary people doing. He's concerned about their well-being. He's concerned about their survival. And he admonishes leaders and he commands leaders to take care of the fatherless and the widow and those who are suffering. And when Jesus came into this world, then he comes not as a king in a palace. He comes to the people that he has always been concerned about. He comes to the ordinary. And he identifies with the ordinary. And that was the case throughout his life, wasn't it? Through his ministry too. Who does he identify with? There he identifies with tax collectors and sinners. He identifies with the lowly. He identifies with women. He identifies with the poor and the weak and the suffering. That was Jesus' great concern, and so it is today. This is the one that Christ comes to. He doesn't come to those who have it all together. He doesn't come to those who are self-confident and self-righteous. He doesn't come to those who can achieve all of their ambitions by their own might, their own power, their own skill. Jesus comes to the ordinary. And he calls to the ordinary to come and follow him. This is the one with whom Christ identifies. But then we need to think about the reason for all of this. The reason for the birth of Christ. Well, the passage doesn't tell us, does it? These particular seven verses are not, they're not explicit about the reason for the birth. But having spoken about the sovereignty of God in bringing Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem in order that he might be born there. And having spoken a bit about the contrast in the circumstances of Jesus before his birth in Bethlehem, he was the King of Glory. He was the one who was sovereign over all of the universe. We need to ask the question, well, why then did he come? Why did he leave his position of power and authority to come into this world? If he was sovereignly ruling over all things, if he was the King of Glory, why did he come into this world? Why was he born? Why was he born in Bethlehem? Why was he born to these ordinary people? Why was he born in such ordinary, humble circumstances? We must ask, what is the reason for the birth of the Son of God as a man? Why were you born? Well, you were born so that you could live. Well, we take it for granted, don't we? But you were born so that you could live. Now, we could say a lot more about that, and as Christians, we would say that you were born so that you can live to the glory of God. Isn't it? You were created to glorify God. This is the reason for your birth. But Jesus wasn't born to live in the same way. Yes, he was born to live, but ultimately the reason that Jesus was born was so that he could die. None of you were born in order to die. Death comes to us all. It is appointed to every man to die, but that's because we are born with a sinful nature, as we were learning in the Catechism. We're born with a sinful nature, and so we are destined to die because we are sinners, but we weren't made so that we would die. When Adam was created, he wasn't created so that he would die. When Eve was made from his rib, she wasn't made for his rib so that one day she could die. They were made to live, and to live forever for the glory of God. But Jesus, when Jesus was born, he was born in order to die. That was his planned destiny from the beginning. It wasn't something that just had to happen because, well, that's the course of nature. Everyone who's born dies. No, he was destined to it. It was God's plan. It was God's purpose. It was God's desire that he would die. And while Luke doesn't explicitly say that in this passage, Matthew does record the angel telling Joseph that the name of this child must be Jesus or Saviour, because he will save his people from their sins. And it points to the destiny of Jesus. It points to where he is going. And so, yes, he was born to live. He had to live a particular kind of life. He had to live a perfect life. He had to live a life of obedience to God. He had to live a life that glorified God. Or to put it another way, he had to live the life that humanity was originally created to live. A perfect life of obedience and service to God. He had to do that because he came into the world to be a representative for his people, to stand in their place before God, and to be able to say, I, on behalf of these people, have done what you wanted. I have lived a life of obedience to your law. I've lived a life that has glorified you. And I have done it for these people. These people are mine. I've done it for them. So he was born to live this perfect life as a representative for his people. But ultimately he was born to die, to take the sins of his people and to have them credited to him as though they are his so that he could be a substitute for his people in paying the penalty. He was judged by God as he hung upon the cross, and he was declared to be guilty of all the sins of his people, and he paid the price of those sins upon the cross. The reason that Jesus was born in Bethlehem under those circumstances was so that he could die on a cross outside Jerusalem, having perfectly obeyed the law of God, but humbly submitting to the will of God that he be a sacrifice for the sins of his people. So the birth of Jesus was intended for our benefit. And that's why we celebrate Christmas, isn't it? We celebrate the birth of Jesus not because we're celebrating someone's birthday. It's not just that. Yes, it's Jesus' birthday, as we've decided it should be on the 25th of December. That's when we're going to celebrate the birth of Jesus. Just like we celebrate each person's birthday in this room at the appropriate time, at the appropriate dates of the year, we celebrate someone's birthday. But we don't celebrate the birth of Jesus just because he was born. We celebrate the birth of Jesus because of why he was born. That he was born to die for his people, to take their sins, and to reconcile them to God, to remove the judgment that they deserve and the punishment that they deserve. And that's the reason for the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. It was an ordinary birth, and yet it was so extraordinary. Not so much because of the strangeness of his surroundings, though those were strange surroundings, but it was an extraordinary birth because of where he came from heaven, and what he came for, to die. And I hope that this morning you may have grasped something more of the wonder of Christmas, of this season in which we celebrate the birth of that baby so long ago. And perhaps for once in your life you've begun to realise that the birth of the baby Jesus was something that God had planned, that God purposed, that God brought about, and he did so for the good of people like you and me.